The following sermon by John Owen is called Righteous Zeal Encouraged by Divine Protection, with a discourse about toleration and the duty of the civil magistrate, about religion, thereunto annexed. The following sermon was preached before the House of Commons on January 31, 1648, which had been appointed as a day of solemn humiliation in connection with the event of the preceding day, the decapitation of Charles I. Accordingly, no sermon of Owen has excited keener discussion, because he consented to preach in these circumstances. He is held to have connived at a great crime and actually invested it with the sanctions of religion. But in the opinion of Dr. McCree, see Miscellaneous Writings, page 501, his conduct in this instance was the greatest blot on his public life, and both his text and the title of his sermon could not fail to be interpreted as encouragement to those who have been accessory to the destruction of the unhappy monarch. But, on the other hand, some, like William Orme, urged that Owen preach by command, that no sentiment of the sermon can be construed as approval of the regicide, and that the very passages, adduced in proof that Owen concurred in it, indicate his desire to keep free and aloof from the expression of any positive opinion on the subject. From John Owen to the Right Honorable, the Commons of England assembled in Parliament. Sirs, it has always suited the wisdom of God to do great things in difficult seasons. He sets up walls in troublous times. Daniel 9:25. His builders must hold swords and spears as well as instruments of labor. Nehemiah 4:16. Yea, while sin continues in its course here which began in heaven, and heaven contemporized with the earth shall live forever in hell, great works for God will cause great troubles amongst men. The holy, harmless reconciler of heaven and earth bids us expect the sword to attend his undertakings for and way of making peace. Matthew 10:34. All the waves in the world arise to their height and roaring from the confronting of the breath of God's Spirit, and the vapors of men's corruptions. Hence seasons receive their degree of difficulty according to the greatness and weight of the works which in them God will accomplish. To their worth and excellency is man's opposition proportioned. This, the instruments of its glory in this generation shall continually find true, to their present trouble and future comfort, as the days approach for the delivery of the decree to the shaking of heaven and earth, and all the powers of the world to make way for the establishment of that kingdom which shall not be given to another people. The great expectation of the saints of the Most High before the consummation of all things. So tumults, troubles, vexations, and disquietness must certainly grow and increase among the sons of men. Keep in mind before I read this sermon that John Owen was a mere 32 years old preaching before Parliament. The sermon is called Righteous Zeal Encouraged by Divine Protection. Let them return to you, but do not return to them, and I will make you to this people a fenced, brazen wall, and it shall fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you to save you and to deliver you, saith the Lord. Jeremiah 15:19-20. The words of my text, having a full dependence upon and flowing out from the main subject matter of the whole chapter, I must of necessity take a view of it, and hold out to you the mind of God contained in it, before I enter upon the part of it chiefly intended. And this I shall do with very brief observations, that I may not anticipate myself from a full opening and application of the words of my text. And this, or rather, are my thoughts led to, because the whole transaction of things between the Lord and a stubbornly sinful nation, exceedingly accommodated to the carrying on of the controversy he is now pleading with that in which we live, is set out, as we say, to the life therein. Of the whole chapter there are five parts. First, the denunciation of fearful, wasting, destroying judgments against Judah and Jerusalem, verse 3 and so on to verse 10. Secondly, the procuring deserving cause of these overwhelming calamities, verses 4 and 6. Thirdly, the inevitableness of these judgments and the inexorableness of the Lord as to the accomplishment of all the evils denounced, verse 1. Fourthly, the distinct condition of the prophet with the frame and deportment of his spirit under those bitter dispensations of providence, verse 10, and verses 15 to 18. Fifthly, the answer and appearance of God to him upon the making out of his complaint, verses 11 to 14 and 9 to 21. My text lies in the last part, but yet with such dependence on the former as enforces to a consideration of them. First, there is a denunciation of fearful, wasting, destroying judgments to sinful Jerusalem, verse 2, and so onwards, with some interposed ejaculations concerning her inevitable ruin, as verses 5 and 6. Here, death, sword, famine, captivity, verse 2, banishment, verse 4, unpitied desolation, verse 5, redoubled destruction, bereaving, fanning, spoiling, and so on, in verses 6 to 9. That universal devastation of the whole people which came upon them in the Babylonish captivity is a thing here intended. The means of its accomplishment by particular plagues and judgments in their several kinds, for the greater dread and terror, being at large enumerated. The faithfulness of God also being made by this to show more clear in the dispersion of that people, doing not only for the main what before he had threatened, but in particular executing the judgments recorded, Luke 21, verse 24, and so on. Deuteronomy 38, 15 to 57, fulfilling by this what he had devised, accomplishing the word he had commanded in the days of old, Lamentations 2, 17. That which hence I shall observe is only from the variety of these particulars, which are held out as a means of the intended desolation. Observation. God's treasures of wrath against a sinful people have sundry and various issues for the accomplishment of the appointed end. When God walks contrary to a people, it is not always in one path. He has seven ways to do it, and will do it seven times, Leviticus 26, verse 24. He does not strike always with one weapon nor in one place, as there is with him manifold and various grace. 1 Peter 4, verse 10, love and compassion making out itself in choice variety, suited to our manifold indigencies. So there is, Romans 2, verse 5, stored, treasured wrath, suiting itself and its flowings out to the provocations of stubborn sinners. The first emblem of God's wrath against man was a flaming sword turning itself every way, Genesis 3, 24. Not only in one or two, but in all their paths, he meets them with his flaming sword, as a wild beast in a net. So are sinners under inexorable judgments. The more they strive, the more they are enwrapped and entangled. They shuffle themselves from under one calamity and fall into another, as if a man did flee from a lion, and a bear met him. Or he went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall, and a serpent bit him, Amos 5, verse 19. Oh, remove this one plague, saith Pharaoh. If he can escape from under this pressure, he thinks he shall be free. But when he fled from the lion, still the bear met him. And when he went into the house, the serpent bit him. And as the flaming sword turns every way, so God can put it into everything. To those that cry, give me a king, God can give him in his anger. And from those that cry, take him away, he can take him away in his wrath. Hosea 13, verses 10 and 11. Oh, that this might seal up instruction to our own souls. What variety of calamities have we been exercised with for a number of years? What Pharaoh-like spirits have we had under them? Oh, that we were delivered this once, and then all were well. How do we spend all our thoughts to extricate ourselves from our present pressures? If this hedge, this pit were passed, we should have smooth ground to walk on, not considering that God can fill our safest paths with snares and serpents. Give us peace. Give us wealth. Give us as we were, with our own in quietness. Poor creatures, suppose all these desires were insincerity, and on as with a most they are fair colours of foul and bloody designs. Yet a peace were, and wealth were, and former things were, and God were not. What would it avail you? Cannot he poison your peace and canker your wealth? And when you were escaped out of the field from the lion and the bear, appoint a serpent to bite you, leaning upon the walls of your own house. In vain do you seek to stop the streams while the fountains are open. Turn yourselves whithersoever you will. Bring yourselves into what condition you can. Nothing but peace and reconciliation with the God of all these judgments can give you rest in the day of visitation. You see what variety of plagues are in his hand. Changing of condition will do no more to the avoiding of them than a sick man's turning himself from one side of the bed to another. During this turning, he forgets his pain by striving to move. Being laid down again, he finds his condition the same as before. This is a fair thing. We are under various judgments from which by ourselves there is no deliverance. Secondly, the second thing here expressed is a procuring cause of these various judgments set down in verse 4. Because of Manasseh, son of Hezekiah, king of Judah, for that which he did in Jerusalem, the sins of Manasseh fell to Ephah of Judah's wickedness, and caused a talon of lead to be laid on the mouth of it. Oftentimes in the relation of a story does the Holy Ghost emphatically express this, that for his sin Judah should be destroyed, 2 Kings 21:11. Yea, when they had a little reviving under Josiah, and the bowels of the Lord began to work in compassion towards them, yet, as it were, remembering the provocation of this Manasseh, he recalls his thoughts of mercy, 2 Kings 23:26-27. The deposing of divine and human things is oftentimes very opposite. God himself proceeds with them in a diverse dispensation. In the spiritual bodies, the members offend, and the head is punished. The iniquity of us all did meet on him, Isaiah 53:1. In the civil politic body, the head offends, and the members rue it. Manasseh sins, and Judah must go captive. Three things present themselves for the vindication of the equity of God's righteous judgments and the recompensing the sins of the king upon the people. 1, the concurrence and influence of the people's power to their ruling government. They that set him up may justly be called to answer for his miscarriage. The Lord himself had before made the sole bottom of that political administration to be their own wills, if he will have a king, after the manner of the nations. Deuteronomy 17:14, 1 Samuel 8:7. Though for particulars himself, according to his supreme sovereignty, placed in many, appointed many of the kings, by peculiar exemption, otherwise his providence was served by their plenary consent, or by such dispensation of things as you have here related, 1 Kings 16:21-22. Then were the people of Israel divided into two parts. Half of the people followed Tibni, the son of Ganath, to make him king, and half followed Omri. But the people that followed Omri prevailed against the people that followed Tibni, so Tibni died and Omri reigned. Now they who place men in authority to be God's vicegerents, to undertake to God for the deportment in that authority, and therefore may justly bear the sad effects of their sinful miscarriages. 2, because for fear of Manasseh's cruelty, or to flatter him in his tyranny for their own advantage, the greatest part of the people had apostatized from the ways and worship of Hezekiah, to comply with him in his sin, as at another time they willingly walked after the commandment. Hosea 5:11. And this is plainly expressed in 2 Kings 21:9. Manasseh seduced the people to do more evil than the nations. When kings turn seducers, they seldom lack good store of followers. Now if the blind lead the blind, both will, and both justly may, fall into the ditch. When kings command unrighteous things, and people suit them with willing compliance, no one doubts but the destruction of them both is just and righteous. See verse 6 of this chapter. Number 3. Because the people, by virtue of their retained sovereignty, did not restrain him in his provoking ways. So sing what he says. When Saul would have put Jonathan to death, the people would not allow him to do so, but deliver Jonathan that he did not die. And David proposed a reducing of the ark. His speech to the people was, "If it seem good to you, let us send abroad to our brethren everywhere, that they may gather themselves to us." And all the congregation said that they would do so, because the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. 1 Chronicles 13:2-4. So they bargained with Rehoboam about their subjection upon condition of a moderate rule. 1 Kings 12. By virtue of which power also they delivered Jeremiah from the prophets and priests that would have him put to death. Jeremiah 26:16. And on this ground might they justly feed on the fruit of their own neglected duty. Be it thus, or otherwise, by what way soever the people had their interest in it, certain it is that for the sins of Manasseh, one way or other made their own, they were destroyed. And therefore, these things being written for our example, it cannot but be of great concern to us to know what were the sins which wrapped up the people of God in irrevocable destruction. Now these the Holy Ghost fully manifests in the story of the life and reign of this Manasseh, and they may all be reduced to 2 chief heads. 1. False worship, or superstition. He built high places, made altars for Baal, and a grove, as did Ahab, 2 Kings 21:3. Number 2. Cruelty. He shed innocent blood very much, till he had filled Jerusalem with blood from one end of it to another. Verse 16. Whether this cruelty is to be ascribed to his tyranny in civil affairs. And so the bloodshed is called innocent because not of malefactors, or to his persecution and subordination to his false worship, instituted as before, as the Pope and his adherents have devoured whole nations, is not apparent. But this is from hence, in other places most evident, that superstition and persecution, will worship and tyranny, are inseparable concomitants. Nebuchadnezzar sets up his great image. In the next news you hear, the saints are in the furnace. Daniel 3:20. You seldom see a fabric of human invented worship, but either the foundation or topstone is laid in the blood of God's people. The wisdom, religion, or way of worship that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. James 3:17. When the other is earthly, sensual, devilish, bringing about envy and strife, confusion, and every evil work. Verse 16. Persecution and blood is the genuine product of all invented worship. I might from this name and pursue other observations, but I shall only name one and proceed. Observation. When false worship, with injustice by cruelty, have possessed the governors of a nation, and wrapped in the consent of the greatest part of the people who have been acquainted with the mind of God, that people and nation, without unprecedented mercy, is liable to remediless ruin. Those two are the Baal and the dragon that, what by their actings, or by their deservings, has swallowed up that ocean of blood which has flowed from the veins of millions slain upon the face of the earth. Give me the number of the witnesses of Jesus whose souls under the altar cry for revenge against their false-worshipping murderers, and to tell of them, whose lives have been sacrificed to the insatiable ambition and tyranny of bloodthirsty potentates, with the issues of God's just vengeance on the sons of men, for compliance in these two things. And you will have gathered in a whole harvest of blood, leaving but a few straggling gleanings upon other occasions. And if these things have been found in England, and the present administration with sincere humiliation do not run across to unravel this clove-woven web of destruction, all thoughts of recovery will quickly be too late, and thus far sin and providence drive on a parallel. Thirdly, the inevitableness of the desolation threatened, and the inexorableness of God in the execution of it, verse 1, is a third thing considerable. Though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be toward this people. Should I insist upon this, it would draw me out to scripture evidences of a nation's traveling in sin beyond the line of God's patience, and so not to be exempted from ruin. But instead of this, I shall make it a part of my daily supplications, that they may be to our enemies, if God's enemies in the interpretation of them, to those that hate us. In brief, the words contain an impossible supposition and yet a negation of the thing for whose sake it is supposed. Moses and Samuel were men who, in the days of their flesh, offered up strong supplications and averted many imminent judgments from a sinful people, as if the Lord should say, "All that I can do in such a case as this, I would grant at the intercession of Moses and Samuel, or others interceding in their spirit and zeal. But now the state of things has come to that pass, the time of treaty being expired, the black flag hung out, and the decree having brought forth, Zephaniah 2:2, that upon their utmost entreaty, it shall not be reversed." Observation. There is a time when sin grows ripe for ruin. For three transgressions and for four, the Lord will not turn away the iniquity of a people. Amos 1:9. When the sin of the Amorites had filled the cup of vengeance, they must drink it. Genesis 15:16. England, under several administrations of civil government, has fallen twice, yea thrice, into nation-destroying sins. Providence has once more given it another bottom. If you should stumble, which the Lord avert, at the same block of impiety and cruelty, there is not another sifting to be made. To reserve any grains from the ground, I do not doubt but our three transgressions and four will end in total desolation. The Lord be your guide. Poor England lies at stake. Observation. The greatest difficulty that lies in bringing up total destruction upon a sinful people is the interposition of Moses and Samuel. If Moses would have but stood in the gap and let the Almighty go, he had broken in upon the whole host of Israel. Exodus 32, verses 9 and 10. And let it, by the way, be observed of the spirit of Samuel, that when the people of God were most exorbitant, he cries, "As for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you." 1 Samuel 12:23. Scarce answered by those who, if their interests be not served, or at least their reason satisfied, scarce pray a prayer for, yea, pour out curses against their choicest deliverers. The Lord lay it not to their charge. But for us, seeing that praying deliverers are more prevalent than fighting deliverers, it is, though Moses and Samuel, not Gideon and Samson, stood before me, if some decay, let us gather strength in the Lord, that he may have never the more rest for their giving over, until he establish Mount Zion a praise in the earth. Fourthly, now we come to the fourth thing in this chapter. The prophet's state and condition with the frame and deportment of his heart and spirit under these dispensations. And here we find him expressing the two things of himself. One, what he found from others, verse 10, and number two, what he wrestled with in his own spirit, verses 15 to 18. First, what he found from others. He tells you it was cursing and reproach and so on. "I have neither lent on usury, nor have men lent to me on usury, yet every one of them curses me," verse 10. Now this return may be considered two ways. In itself, every one, he says, as his people curses me. And in reference to his deportment, "I have neither borrowed nor lent on usury, yet they curse me." From the first, observe, instruments of God's greatest works and glory are oftentimes the chiefest objects of a professing people's cursings and revenges. to return which God laborers meet with in this generation, is in a number of those things in which there is none new under the sun. Men that, under God, deliver a kingdom may have the kingdom's curses for their pains. When Moses had brought the people out of Israel, out of bondage, by that wonderful and unparalleled deliverance, being forced to appear with the Lord for the destruction of Korah and its associates, who would have seduced the congregation to its utter ruin, he receives at length this reward of all his travail, labor, and pains. All the congregation gathered themselves against him in Aaron, laying murder and sedition to their charge, telling them that they had killed the people of the Lord. Numbers 16:41-42. A goodly reward for all their travails. If God's works do not suit with the lusts, prejudices, and interests of men, they will labor to give his instruments the devil's wages. Let not upright hearts sink, because they meet with thankless men. A man may have the blessing of God and the curse of a professing people at the same time. Behold, I, and the children whom God has given me, are for signs and wonders in Israel. Isaiah 8:18. Man's condemnation and God's absolution do not seldom meet upon the same persons for the same things. If you labor to do the work of the Lord, pray think it not strange if among men curses be your reward, and detestation your wages. Number 2, in reference to the prophet's deportment. He had neither lent, nor had any lent to him upon usury. He was free from blame among them. He had no dealings with them in those things which are usually attended with reproaches, as he shows by an instance in usury, a thing that a long time has heard very ill. Observation. Men, every way blameless, and to be embraced in their own ways, are oftentimes abhorred and laden with curses for following the Lord in his ways. What precious men should many be, would they let go the work of God in this generation? No advantage against them but in the manner of their God, and that is enough to have them sent to the lions. Daniel 6:5. He that might be honored for compassing the end suiting his own worldly interest, and will cheerfully undergo dishonor for going beyond to suit the design of God, has surely some impression upon a spirit that it is from above. You have the prophet's deportment and the frame of his spirit during those transactions between the Lord and that sinful people, and as he holds out in many pathetical complaints, to be fainting, decaying, perplexed, weary of his burden, not knowing how to ease himself, as you may see at large in verses 15-18. Observation. In dark and difficult dispensations of providence, God's choicest servants are oftentimes ready to faint under the burden of them. How weary was David when he cried out in such a condition, "Oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then would I fly away and be at rest." Psalm 55:6. Long had he waited for a desired end of his perplexed state, and had perhaps oftentimes been frustrated as of his hope of drawing to a period of his miseries, and now, finding one disappointment to follow on the neck of another, he is weary and cries, "What? Nothing but this trouble and confusion still? Oh, that I had wings like a dove, a ship to sail to a foreign nation or the like, there to be at peace, in the like strait another time." See what a miserable conclusion he draws of all his being exercised under the hand of God. Psalm 73:13. "Verily, I've cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency." And again, he says in the perturbation of his mind, "All men are liars." Did all the promises, all the encouragements which in his way he had received from God should fail of their accomplishment? It is not with him as it was with that wicked king of Israel, who being disappointed of peace and deliverance in his own time, cries out, "This evil is of the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? 2 Kings 6:33. The season of deliverance suited not his expectation. Therefore he quite throws off the Lord and his protection. Not unlike many among ourselves, whose desires and expectations not being satisfied in the closing of our distractions, according to the way which themselves had framed for the Lord to walk in, are ready to cast off his cause, his protection, to comply with the enemies of his name. But it may be observed that deliverance did not come to that people until Jehoram was weary of waiting, and then immediately God gives it in. When God is tired of the patience of corrupted men, he will speak peace to them that wait for him. So it is not with the saints of God only, being perplexed in their spirits, dark in their apprehensions, and fainting in their strength. They break out oftentimes into passionate complaints, as Jeremiah for a cottage in the wilderness, but yet for the main holding firm to the Lord. And the reasons of this quelling are 1. The weakness of faith, when the methods of God's proceeding are unfathomable to our apprehensions. While men see the paths in which the Lord walks, they can follow him through some difficulties. But when that is hid from them, though providence so shuts them up all other ways that it is impossible God should be in them, yet if they cannot discern, they are so proud how he goes in, and that in which he is, they are ready to faint and give over. God is pleased sometimes to make darkness his pavilion and a secret place. A fire devours before him, and it is very tempestuous round about him. When once God is attended with fire, darkness, and tempest, because we cannot so easily see him, we are ready to leave him. Now, this the Lord usually does in the execution of his judgments. Your righteousness is like the great mountains. Your judgments are a great deep. Psalm 36, verse 6. His righteousness, his kindness, is like a great mountain that is easy to be seen. A man cannot overlook it unless he willfully shuts his eyes. But his judgments are like the great deep. Who can look into the bottom of the sea or know what is done in the depths of it? God's works and their accomplishment are oftentimes so unsuited to the reasons and apprehensions of men that very many who have been strong in their desires and great in expectation of them, upon their bringing forth to light, have quite rejected and opposed them as none of his, because distant from what they had framed to themselves. It is evident from the gospel that the people of the Jews were full of expectation and longing for the great work of the coming of the Messiah, just at the season in which he came, yet when Jesus came, because he was not accommodated to their pre-imaginations, they rejected him, as having neither form nor comeliness in him to be desired. Isaiah 53, verse 2. And the prophet Amos tells many who desired a day of the Lord that that day should be darkness to them and not light. Amos 5, verses 18 and 20. So in every generation, many desirous of the accomplishment of God's work are shaken off from any share in it by finding it unsuited to their reasons and expectations. Now, when the Lord is pleased us to walk in darkness, many, not being able to trace him in his dispensations, are ready to lie down and sink under the burden. David seems to profess that he had nothing at such a time to uphold him but this, that God must be there or nowhere. I had said, he says, that it was in vain to walk as I do, but that I should have condemned the generation of your children. Psalm 73:15. And truly God never leaves us without so much light, but that we may see clearly where he is not. And so by recounting particulars, we may be rolled where he is, though his goings there are not so clear. Ask if God be in the counsels of men who seek themselves, and in the ways of those who make it their design to ruin the generation of the just. If you find him there, seek no further, and if not, let that give you light to discern where he makes his abode, that you do not turn aside to the flocks of others. Application. Be tender towards those who faint in difficult seasons. If they leave waiting on the Lord because of the evil is of him, as they suppose, if they cast in their lot with a portion of the ungodly, they will in the end perish in their gainsaying. But as for such as, what for lack of light and lack of faith, sit down and sigh in darkness, do not be too hasty in laying further burdens on them. When first a confederacy was entered into by the Protestant princes in Germany against Charles V, Martin Luther himself for a season was bewildered, and did not know what to do until, being instructed in the fundamental laws of the empire, he sat down fully in that undertaking, though the Lord gave it not the desired issue. Our Savior Jesus Christ asks if, when he comes, he shall find faith on the earth. Luke 13, verse 8. It is his coming with the spirit of judgment and burning, a day of trial and visitation he there speaks of. Now, what faith shall be lacking which will not be found in that day? Not the faith of adherence to himself for spiritual life and justification, but of actual closing with him in the things he then does. It shall be rare. Many shall be staggered and faint in that day. And so by the several heads of this chapter have I led you through the very state and condition of this nation at this time. First, variety of judgments are threatened to us and incumbent on us. It's in the first part. Secondly, of these false worship, superstition, tyranny, and cruelty lie in the bottom of it as their procuring causes. Thirdly, these, if renewed under your hand, will certainly bring inevitable ruin upon the whole nation. Fourthly, all which make many precious hearts, what for lack of light and lack of faith, fail and cry out for the wings of a dove. Fifthly, I come in the fifth place to God's direction to you for the future, in the state and condition which being spread in a number of verses, as the Lord gives it to the prophet, I shall meddle with no more of it than is contained in the words which at our entrance I read to you, let them return, and so on. In the words, observe four things. 1. God's direction to the prophet, and in him to all that do his work in such a season as this described. Let them return to you, but do not return to them. Secondly, their assistance and support in pursuance of that direction. I will make you to this people a brazen fenced wall. Thirdly, the opposition with its success and issue, which in that way they should meet with. They shall fight against you, but shall not prevail. Number four, their consolation and success from the presence of the Lord. For I am with you to deliver you. First, there is God's direction. Many difficulties in this troublesome season was a prophet intricated with. The people would not be prevailed with to come up to the mind of God. They continued in their stubbornness. The Lord would not be prevailed with to avert the threatened desolation. What now shall he do? To stand out against the bulk of the people does not suit his earthly interest. To couple with them answers not the discharge of his office. To wait upon them any longer is fruitless. To give up himself to their ways is comfortless. So his complaints, so his moanings. Better lie down and sink under the burden than always to swim against the stream of an unreformable multitude. In this strait, the Lord comes in with his direction. Let them return to you, and so on. You, keep your station. Perform your duty. Do not comply with the children of backsliding. But whatever is the issue, if there be any closing rot, let it be by working them off from their ways of folly. All condescension on your part, where the work of the God is to be done, is in opposition to him. If they return, embrace him freely. If they do not, do your duty constantly. I will close out this sermon with this observation by John Owen. Plausible compliances of men in authority with those against whom they are employed are treacherous contrivances against the God of heaven by whom they are employed. If God is so provoked that he curses him who does his work negligently, What is he by them who do it treacherously? When he gives a sword into the hands of men, and they thrust it into his own bowels. His glory and honor, though things so dear to him, he that is entrusted with it, and does dare not do justice on everyone that dares do injustice, is afraid of the creature, but makes very bold with the Creator. Proverbs 25:2. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a manner. That which God aims to be glorious in, to manifest his attributes by, is the concealing and covering our iniquities in Christ. But if the kings will have glory, if he will not bring upon himself dishonor by dishonoring God, he is to search and find out the transgressions with whose cognizance he is entrusted, and to give to them condign retribution. If the Lord curse them who did not come forth to his help against the mighty, Judges 5:23, what is there due who, being called forth by him, do yet help the mighty against him? For a man to take part with the kingdom's enemies is no small crime. But for a commissioned officer to run from them by whom he is commissioned to take part with the adversary is death without mercy. Yet have not some in our days arrived at a stupendous impudence, that when as private persons they have declaimed against the enemies of the nation, and by that means got themselves into authority, they have made use of that authority to comply with and uphold those by an opposition to whom they got into their authority, which is no less than an atheistical attempt to personate the Almighty to such iniquities as without his appearance they dare not own. But he that justifies the wicked, and he that condemns the just, even they both are an abomination to the Lord. And not only to the Lord, but to good men also. He that says to the wicked, you are righteous, him shall the people curse. Nations shall abhor him. Proverbs 24:24.